You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters, and this week in partnership with Cargill. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. This podcast is all about dairy alternatives, and we're joined by Matthias Bordeaux, Marketing Manager, Texturizers.
Hello.
Caroline Delabruce, Technical Business Development Manager, Dairy.
Hello.
Dries Kouwenberg, Technical Business Development Manager, Dairy.
Hello.
And Hannah Keenan, Business Development Manager, Infuse.
Hi.
Now, let's start off with Matthias. What dairy alternatives are we talking about? And is it really a growing market?
Yeah, so I think a couple of years back, we would have been talking mainly about alternatives to milk and then mainly soy milk. That's definitely changed. So now the market is not just those alternative drinks, but it's also things like alternatives to cheese, to ice cream, to yogurts and desserts, even to creamers and so on. Is it a growing market? Definitely. If we look at the forecast for the next 5 years in terms of value, there's a forecast of up to 20% of compound annual growth rate, meaning that in the next 5 years, the expectation is that the market will grow by 20% every year. So that's definitely massive. Is it big or not? Well, if you would sum up dairy and dairy alternatives as just one category, the value share of dairy alternatives should be around 7% by 2025. So I'll let you judge whether that's big or small. I mean, the evolution is, like I was saying, in the fact that it's not just anymore about the dairy alternative drinks. In fact, we're seeing soy drinks stagnate a little bit over time. Dairy alternative drinks still make up about 80% of the global turnover of the dairy alternative market. But we're seeing, like I was saying, a host of other dairy alternative applications popping up. And those applications grow at a much, much higher rates than milk alternatives. And so if you look at things like, the non-dairy cheeses, the non-dairy ice creams, non-dairy yogurts, your non-dairy desserts, all of these, especially in Europe, in the US, you see every year innovations doubling. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of market activity and a lot of excitement around this market.
So is this still a niche market? Would you consider it niche or is it really going mainstream now?
I think it's definitely fair to say it's going mainstream. We had a study done recently where we found that more than 40% of European shoppers consume both dairy and dairy alternatives. So many of us, we have both products in our fridges. And there's just a couple of percent of consumers who say they only have or they only consume dairy alternative products. You know, in recent years, dairy consumers have just become more open to try new things. You know, we've seen that with consumers embracing things like quark or skyr and all kinds of other products. And it's also the market itself, so the producers themselves trying to diversify a little bit and just add new products into the market. So it's both, you know, consumers asking for more diversity in dairy products, and it's also manufacturers bringing more dairy alternatives to diversify their own offer. The interesting thing is about dairy alternatives and the health perception. I think, you know, whereas if you look at meat alternatives there, it's quite clear that consumers are drawn to alternatives to meat mostly because of health concerns. With dairy, it's not necessarily that strong because consumers generally have a good perception of dairy and health. Now, having said that, we still, in that same study that we did, found about 4 out of 10 consumers who did think you can have a balanced diet without consuming animal-based dairy. And so to the extent that dairy alternative brands could play more on health benefits or expand their health benefits on their products, I think they would be able to win even more consumers over.
So, Hannah, I'm interested in a little bit of specificity. If you can give us a bit more detail, how is the market evolving?
Yeah, absolutely, Stefan. So apart from new types of applications, so the range of products in this space, I think there is a lot more focus on clean label and the nutritional aspect, leading to an explosion in the offer of the second generation protein types. So soy milk has struggled due to the bad press around sourcing from GMO crops, while other non-soy milk alternatives has really rocketed, pea being one of them. So pea is one of the newest ingredients entering this category, benefiting from its high protein content and sustainable credentials. So other more exotic ingredients also we're seeing, such as pistachio and pili nuts. Consumers also are increasingly looking at what's next. I know I for sure am definitely looking at what's next. So going beyond soy, the newer plant alternatives that are less likely to be sourced from genetically modified crops are allergen-free and carry a low carbon footprint. Also, generally, we see a growing interest in ingredients that are associated with added nutritional value, so such as oats linked to high fiber, walnuts that's linked to omega-3 content, and pea, again, as I mentioned, linked to high protein. So also another of interesting protein source, and also another topic that we see coming through and emerging, is ancient grains, in general, including quinoa. Millet and teff are also in the spotlight, and although being niche, they represent an important opportunity. So given that they're not genetically modified and boast an impressive nutritional profile.
So Matthias, are dairy alternatives beginning to actually replace real dairy, or do you think they complement dairy?
I think they're really complementary, and you know, both can coexist next to one another, and in fact they do, right? So there's a lot of dairy manufacturers that benefit from the plant-based movement. You've got many big names in dairy that are leveraging the trend as a means of either revamping their struggling brands or as a means of extending the success on the brands that they have today. And you can see more and more of those products, of course, sitting next to each other in the same aisle. And yeah, so I really think there's a complementary element there. Now, if you look at the nutritional aspect of most widespread plant-based alternatives, it's clear that most of them are less nutrient-dense than cow's milk. There's very little consumer awareness of this now, but might represent one of the biggest challenges, I think, for plant-based dairy alternatives in the future. Protein concentration and protein quality, we know, is quite key, and consumer demand for protein keeps on increasing. And that's where we see clearly that cow's milk protein outperforms most of the plant-based variants, with soy being maybe the only comparable option for now. And that's also why soy was being used for so long. But then even in comparison with soy, the milk protein caseins are of higher quality in terms of their amino acid profile. Then you've got the minerals and the vitamins, particularly calcium and vitamin B12. That are significantly superior in cow's milk, which is why plant-based alternatives tend to be fortified to be nutritionally competitive. But then I think even more importantly today, it's clear that there's still a lot of work to be done on the taste and texture of, let's say, of those plant-based alternatives. Consumers really love the taste of their real dairy products, and they're not about to give them up altogether. And we also found that in our studies, where we had around 66%, so 2 out of 3, of European dairy consumers preferring the taste of real dairy versus the taste of dairy alternatives. So from a consumer point of view, the first thought we have about cow milk is its sensory attributes, like the smoothness, the soft and the sweet taste. And, you know, many people grow up by drinking cow milk, and they're used to its unique taste. And so that's really the big challenge for dairy alternative products.
So, Dries, why is it so difficult to get really good tasting dairy alternative products?
Well, Stefan, the big challenge is to mimic real milk's unique properties. Just consider all the different foodstuffs that are being made from this one single food ingredient. Think about cheese, yogurt, ice cream, cream. And all of these, they have one thing in common. They're all oil and water emulsions. So you have a watery matrix with the lactose and the minerals, and then dispersed in that, you have the milk fat globules, very tiny milk fat globules, and they are kept from floating on top by a very unique molecule, which is the milk protein, the milk casein protein, and that is putting itself on that interface between the fat and then the water. And the big challenge is really to mimic that molecule's unique properties.
Caroline, there are, I mean, we're hearing about more and more different alternative protein sources to replace that casein protein. Surely one of them should do the trick.
Well, actually, it's not that easy to make that choice because, as Tris explained, it's difficult to match the unique properties of milk protein, like the casein. And also, all these alternative protein sources, they are so different. Different in many ways. First, if when you look at the organoleptic and texturizing properties, some of these proteins, they are more milk-like, and others, they are more water-like. But that means they do not bring anything alone. And regarding the taste, some of them, they have a pretty strong taste, and others, they are quite neutral. Also, there's a difference in color compared to the whiteness of milk. So when you have to choose an alternative protein sources to the milk, you need to ask yourself some questions. First one, it's about texture. Can it be optimized for the process, either the acidification, the fermentation, or through the heat treatment? Yes or no? Second question, does this protein have emulsifying properties like milk? Third question, how does it interact with other ingredients? And here I think especially with some texturizers like Kerganand, which is often used in dairy products. And there are also questions also about the protein content, how much protein varies, about allergens, and also some very important and determining are the sourcing availability and also the cost in use to make the right choice regarding the alternative protein. So these are some basic questions to ask yourself to choose the right one. So there is no plant-based proteins to replace at 100% the milk protein. And today, the bulk of alternative proteins used is still soy since many years. And then in dairy alternative products, almonds and coconuts, they are coming in at second place. And both coconut and almonds, they have a nice taste and they are very well known by consumers. But these plants, they are very poor in the protein content. So they cannot replace the milk as such. And recently, other proteins arrived to market proteins like pea, rice, oats. And these proteins, they are growing very rapidly. At Cargill, we have been investigating many of these proteins to be able to recommend the protein basis to our customers that we think work well in terms of texture, on taste and protein content, and also to know how to work with a plant-based protein that our customers may already have chosen, or to advise them how to best formulate that protein with other ingredients in the recipe.
So is there any one particular protein that you would usually recommend?
Today, definitely, we recommend the use of pea protein. We are working a lot on pea protein, which has clear advantages. Pea protein gets very close to soy in terms of texturizing property, and it is a non-GMO protein. Compared to soy, it has fewer allergens, and it's also better perceived by the consumers. Regarding the functionality, pea protein is efficient, it's versatile. You can form a gel through heat treatment or fermentation or acidification. It contains a high amount of protein, and it shows great milk-like texture and mouthfeel, which is very interesting for dairy alternative products. And because of these benefits, at Cargill, we are working hard on pea protein, and we are developing our offer, which is a wide range with different functionalities for different applications, like dairy alternatives, plant-based beverages, and also meat alternatives.
So after you've chosen your protein, Dries, what is the next step?
Well, next step is the selection of your veg oil. Consider just comparing full fat milk to skim milk. You immediately notice the impact of the oil on the taste experience of a dairy product. And when you've selected your protein source, and you're testing about, you will very rapidly notice what is missing, what functionality, what key functionality is missing compared to the real deal. So that can be taste release, structure, texture, all such kind of features that you're missing. So then it's about selecting the right texturizers and vegetable oils.
And let's look at this on a real practical level and look at some specific usage. How does it work, for instance, in vegan cheese, which is such a rapidly growing category?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So vegan cheese, once you've got your protein that will mimic the casein network in from real cheese, you will have a certain firmness, you will have a certain mouthfeel as well while eating, and then the properties that are important for cheese, like the ability to grate or to slice the cheese. And that is all coming from the protein, but you will need an additional functionality. It may be that the cheese is very gel-like or very rubbery-like or gives a very dry mouthfeel, for instance. And then that's where the oil phase comes in. So by the right selection of the oil, you can bring that additional creamy texture, the creamy taste, that lovely dairy mouthfeel that you would have in the real cheese. And for that, we have a wide array of very, very functional veg oils to choose from that we can use to replace milk fat.
And but aren't vegetable fats less functional than animal-based oils?
Well, quite on the contrary, I would say, because we have the advantage of choice. So there's not only on functionality, also nutrition. We have a much broader, a much bigger toolbox to select our veg oils from. Think about also when we consider the botanical origin, for instance. Think about seed oils with rapeseed oil, sunflower oil, linseed oil, all sorts of different very healthy seed oils to choose from. And then you've got texture-bringing oils like the lauric oils, coconut oil, palm kernel oil. Very nice one. And then palm oil, sustainable palm oil with all its fractions. So on top of that, we can put to use all sorts of refining techniques, and we can then blend all them together to really optimize the properties of the oil phase and even get to a functionality that is better above it, that goes beyond and above the functionality of milk.
So, Caroline, do you only need vegetable proteins and fats?
No, definitely no. You need some functional ingredients. besides vegetable proteins and fats. Functional ingredients like texturizers, because you will not find a vegetable protein or vegetable fats which can cover all functionalities of the dairy protein. And so you will have to compensate for the loss of some functionalities like emulsification, gelling, thickening, etc. And for some changing formulations like plant-based processed cheese, we use some texturizing solutions like some starches alone or in combination with other hydrocolloids like carrageenans. Both starches and carrageenans are texturizers coming from nature, so they are plant-based. Starches are made from different plant-based sources, corn, potatoes, tapioca. And carrageenans, they are made from some red seaweeds. So they fit perfectly with plant-based formulations. Coming back on starches, they are well known because of their water binder effect. They bring the viscosity and also some gelling texture. And some starches, they have some emulsifying properties. So they can be used to replace milk proteins in plant-based cheeses, and that help to stabilize the emulsion. So at Cargill, we have a broad range of starches that allow us to develop tailor-made solutions according to the target process cheese recipe, texture, and process. We have also a very long experience in making carrageenans, more than 60 years, to support a large variety of textures and needs in formulations. Carrageenans are used in processed cheese. I'll give you one example. We use them to make sliced cheese you have in your hamburger. Here, the carrageenan, they bring the gelling texture, but also the melting, the baking stability, which is well requested for this the stability of cheese during in the hamburger.
So what about vegan yogurts and desserts? How do they work and what's needed there?
So let's start with yogurt, where the key components are the proteins. And more in dairy yogurt, in milk yogurt, we talk about caseins. Yogurt is the most commonly known dairy product by consumers. You make yogurt by fermentation of the milk with lactic bacteria. And this fermentation drives to the acidification of the milk and transforms the casein to form a curd, which is a milk proteins gel. So clearly, the challenge here when you use some plant-based components, plant-based proteins, is to know their compatibility with fermentation and their stability also in acidic conditions, which is not the case for all protein sources. According to the nature of plant proteins, fermentation will not lead to the same texture. And so here, texturizers are widely used to build up the desired texture. So there is a large variety of plant-based proteins with potential texturizing properties available on the market. We first think about soy proteins, which are the most used ones for plant-based yogurts. It's because these soy proteins and they can be texturized by acidification or fermentation technology. So they bring a smooth and creamy texture to the yogurt. And they can be considered to be more milk-like proteins, where you don't need so much additional texturization or adding texturizers, which is also the same for the pea proteins. But other plant-based sources, like coconut and almond, they are more water-like. They don't have specific properties in fermentation. And they cannot be texturized by fermentation to make this creamy and spoonable texture for yogurt. So when you replace dairy protein in yogurt, and also the case for dairy desserts, when we experience changes around taste, texture, for example, the dryness, the lack of creaminess compared to dairy yogurt.
So which ingredients would you use in particular?
For plant-based yogurts, the most common texturizing solutions are starches and pectin. Starches here provide the viscosity, the creaminess, the shininess, the smoothness to the yogurt. In fat-reduced recipes, we can use some emulsifying starches, which are used to mimic the fat mouthfeel. So pectin is used in combination with starches. It's a plant-based texturizer. At Cargill, we are producing pectin from apple and also from citrus peels like lemon or orange. And in plant-based yogurt, pectin are used to improve the stability of texture and create a smooth gel. We can use also pectins in to stabilize also drinking plant-based yogurt, and they help to limit, to control the sedimentation of proteins or insoluble matters. So that's for yogurts. If we talk about plant-based desserts, and if we want to make plant-based desserts, usually named as pudding, vla, crème dessert, natillas, etc., depending on the country. For plant-based desserts, the gelling and thickening properties are required and brought by the combination of starch and carrageenan. The main challenge in this dessert is to compensate the loss of milk proteins interaction we have with carrageenans. And that's why carrageenans are widely used in dairy desserts, and they contribute a lot to the texture. The last point in plant-based desserts, it's the lower dry matter content. There is a lower dry matter content compared to milk desserts. And this loss is fulfilled by using these two texturizers, which are starches and carrageenan.
Now, Hannah, my head's already spinning with all the possibilities and the technical kind of aspects to all this. How do you, it must be difficult to cope with the sheer speed of innovation in this area as a manufacturer. Just everything just seems to change so often, so rapidly.
Yeah, I completely agree. Absolutely. This market, it's really changing fast with new protein bases and new types of products that are popping up all the time. So it's really important to keep offering a broad range of these protein alternative solutions. This market's very dynamic, and we see a lot of innovators and entrepreneurs that are very, very successful quickly, but then they fail fast. Also, retailers are expecting that new products are put on their shelves quickly, again, to show their success in this new area, or else you may not remain on the shelf along with your product. So that's again why it's really important to have the right ingredient partner that can be as agile as you need them to be in this ever-evolving market. So the consumer trends, as we say, are vastly and radically on the move. And in today's environment, we need to react quickly and, more importantly, understand the challenges faced when removing these key functional ingredients that my colleagues have already been discussing, so we can launch those new products into the market as fast as possible. So that's one of the main reasons why Cargill, we have launched a new service called Infuse by Cargill, which is an offer to our customers to help them reformulate their products, enabling them to stay ahead. We offer a blend of ingredients, and again, Dries and Caroline have already taken us through the synergies and the replacement of these key functional and sensory properties when we're removing the protein, animal-based protein. And again, it's really key to point out that this allows the customer to simplify and really speed up their project development from start to finish. So allowing that launch much quicker than a traditional innovation cycle.
So, Matthias, just clearly the challenges on texture and taste are pretty complex. What do you think will be the challenges of tomorrow? Let's put your future gazing specs on and tell us about what the future holds.
Right, Stefan. Well, I think I've alluded it already at some of it in the beginning of our talk. I think as the industry resolves that initial taste and texture challenge, the next challenges will be on making the end products more label friendly and on improving, especially on the nutritional aspects. I mean, today, all those vegan, vegetarian, plant-based labels in consumers' minds are associated with healthy products, right? And they may not yet be getting the same scrutiny that some of the dairy products are getting in terms of the ingredient list that's on the back of pack. But I think as they'll become more mainstream, it won't be long before consumers do take an interest into the ingredient list. And I think a lot of them are already doing that and are asking questions about how many ingredients does this product have? Does it need to have this many ingredients? What's, you know, the level of processing of those ingredients and so on? I think... you obviously have a lot of formulations where a lot of different ingredients are combined. So today, you know, it's still difficult to answer that question. But in the not so distant future, we're really going to have to work on that aspect of, you know, the label friendliness of those products. The other thing to look out for is, of course, in continental Europe, there's a lot of countries where we're now seeing the introduction of the Nutri-Score. You know, which is a system to rate products in terms of their nutrition, from A being the best product to E being the worst product in terms of nutrition. There's a lot of questions around it, whether that's the right way to do it, but a lot of retailers are using that Nutri-Score already today in continental Europe. Of course, in the UK, you've got your traffic light system. So what that does to the flexitarian consumer who now compares the original, let's say, real dairy product with the dairy alternative, you know, that gives him or her really a comparison. And in many cases, the dairy alternative product doesn't come out too well in that comparison. So I think we're going to see a lot of drive into label-friendly and plant-based, more protein-enriched products, more products with high fiber content, and a lot of, you know, communication around that on the packs of those products. It could also play out in other ways, like you'll probably have more blends of different proteins so that you get, you know, to the best functionality and nutritional level. And that can be a blend of different plant-based proteins to get to that. But it could also be, and we're seeing that already in the States, hybrids of both animal protein and plant-based protein. And then you can really get to a point where you get to a higher protein content, but also the desired sugar level. You're still lowering the animal-based protein content, but you're kind of maintaining the taste. So that's something that's very, very interesting. So yeah, it's clean label, nutrition, sustainability, and they're all elements that, you know, as Cargill, we're also working on and we're ready to support our customers on as the space grows and evolves and, you know, we're all.
Well, thank you to everyone. That was amazingly informative and my head's going to be spinning for quite some time. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters and this week in partnership with Cargill. You heard from Matthias Bordeaux, Caroline de la Bruce, Dries Kouwenberg, Hannah Keenan, and me, Stefan Gates. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to the circular food economy. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.